This is The Loving Project, a podcast celebrating the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia by featuring the stories of interracial married couples.
In 1967, the Supreme Court struck down state laws banning marriage between people of different races. The ruling was the result of a case involving Mildred and Richard Loving, a black woman and a white man, who were arrested and then forced to leave their home state of Virginia after they married.
In this episode, we hear from a couple who got married not long after the Supreme Court issued its ruling in Loving v. Virginia. Florence is African-American and grew up in Greensboro, North Carolina. She remembers being a child there and hearing about the sit-ins that led to the Woolworth department store ending its policy of racial segregation.
Ed is white and grew up in Arkansas, where he remembers seeing the Army on its way to Little Rock to escort the first African-American students to school at Little Rock Central High following school desegregation. They met in Nashville, Tennessee, where Ed was a student at Vanderbilt and Florence attended Fisk, one of the country's many historically black universities.
When I look at the two of us and our life together over the past 48 years, we're very ordinary people. There's nothing extraordinary about us. We found ourselves, because of the time period in which we were born, doing something that was out of the ordinary by getting married.
I'm Ed. I'm white.
I'm Florence. I'm African American. We have two sons, Gregory and Philip, and one granddaughter, Lucha, who we absolutely adore. We were married December 27th, 1968, just about 17 months after the Loving decision. A family friend who was an attorney wanted us to know that if we were planning to be married in North Carolina, which is where my parents lived, and that was our plan, we couldn't because it would be illegal unless this case was decided in favor of the Lovings. Had the decision gone the other way, we were going to still be married, but the wedding was going to take place in Boston, where we were living.
I was quite prepared to be married in Boston because I knew we could get married in Boston. But I also knew that marriage in a state where it is legal does not necessarily have that same legality in another state. So when the decision did come down, I recall getting a phone call from Florence's mother and her mother having said, you can be married here now. And we then began making those plans and we were married in Greensboro in the family church. And it was recognized as a valid marriage everywhere across the land.
But we did carry our marriage certificate
with us everywhere.
In the glove compartment of our car.
That's right.
For at least a couple of years before I think we felt safe enough to say, we're married or something. When I think back on it now, I think how bizarre that was. Other couples don't even think about doing that. But we felt somehow that we might be called upon to prove that we had some legal status.
We never did.
We never had to whip it out. I think after 2 years, we just put it away.
Put it with the wedding dress.
The thought that there would be a legal issue with two people making a decision about their personal life just never occurred to me. And quite frankly, I have a suspicion that maybe my parents hadn't thought of it either. Neither of them said to us, well, gee, I don't know whether that's even legal. No one said that to us. At all. You know, people would frown upon it. We would be subject to other people's sense of morality or religion or whatever. Mm-hmm. But never that we had hit some sort of legal bar. Never would have occurred to me.
Yep, nor I. I guess if we'd gone to find out what's first, well, blood test, what's next, license. Oh, you can't get a license. But it certainly was the case that the courthouse in that space where you give your results of your blood test and your marriage license you request, that the two little matrons there made it very clear that they were not happy.
They didn't approve.
They did not approve, so we were quite clear on that. But there was a basket of Christmas goodies, you know, fruit and candy and so on, several baskets over at the end of the counter. And I noted those because I was probably a little hungry, and turned out Florence noted.
No, it was the gift bags that they...
The gift bags, yeah, that's what, yeah. What I was...
But they were household products, not candy.
Well, I thought they were fruit.
Yeah, I know. I know. It was household.
They were household.
The story
you
said tell is that we were maybe second or third couple in line, so we're sitting, and I noticed that the two couples before us, two white couples, they'd given this little gift basket to that had little household products in them. Trust me, not interested in household products. But, you know, it was congratulations and have a nice day. And we go up, and she took our papers and she took them back and she couldn't... Da, 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 da. Finally, whoever she was taking them to and back must have said, just stamp it and sign it, you have to. And she did. And there was no congratulations, have a nice day. And, you know, we turned to leave and I thought, where's our gift basket? So I simply said, where's our gift basket? And we got a gift basket.
I know we got a gift
basket. I don't think we ever.
Oh.
I don't even know what was in it. I don't even know if we used it.
Yeah, it was fruit.
But, you know, maybe it was fruit. And a box of Tide.
It was 1965, and the director of a brand new program had put out a call for college students who would be interested in serving as counselors and mentors for the brand new first ever Upward Bound program for high school juniors and seniors to better prepare them for college. I went to the meeting. It was held at Fisk. Florence was a student at Fisk, and she also attended the meeting. Florence made herself known to me in a very positive, attractive way by her presence, her comments, her questions during the course of the meeting.
What I recall, and I do recall Ed from that meeting, and most of what I recall was that he was there with a young man that was becoming increasingly irritating because he seemed to be taking up... a lot of oxygen in the room, whereas his friend was quieter and seemed to speak only when he had something significant to say. And I thought to myself, boy, I hope that guy who's sucking up all the oxygen doesn't become a part of the program. But it wouldn't be bad to have the other guy because he seems smart. Now, I had come with a bunch of friends. After the meeting, the guy who had driven said, you know, we're parked two or three blocks away. I'll go get the car. You guys just want to stay here and we'll come back and get you. So we're standing outside and Ed came up to me and said, so do you need a ride home? And, you know, being the smartass that I was in those days, no, thank you. I'll go home with the people who brought me. And he said, oh, well, I just, you know, I saw you standing here and I thought maybe you needed a ride. And he persisted just a little bit too much. To the extent that I sort of turned my back on him, I thought, am I going to have to say to you, I don't know you, and you're a white guy. I am so not getting in the car with a white guy that I don't know. But we were both hired by the program. We did end up being placed together and working together with the responsibility of some 40 students, mm-hmm. sort of brought us closer together. By the time we got to the summer, we were clearly exclusively dating.
And the attraction was someone who was well-spoken. I didn't see the TVCs, that's typical Vanderbilt co-eds, in anything like a human person who actually had feelings of something other than whatever highlights they would place around their eyes. Or I'm just trying to, I didn't like TVCs.
I was cute and he was 19. That was the deal.
Well, that too.
That was the deal. Okay.
Also, Florence, in her own right, was quite attractive.
See, that's what I mean. I think it was that first impression that this was someone who, you know, wasn't overly into himself, seemed to me quite sensitive and aware of other people around him, very willing and very generous with wanting to include others in a very sort of natural kind of way. And he was smart, you know, and who isn't attracted to someone who's really smart? And as we got to know one another, then of course I realized that, you know, he had this slightly wicked sense of humor. You know, it was very quiet, that he would test the waters and then boom with something that would just make you want to fall off your chair laughing at the most inappropriate time or inappropriate place, you know. And I thought, he's really trying to break me down here, as it were. And I think part of it certainly was that he was persistent. He let me know over a period of time that he sort of understood that I was leery of the match. And I just kept telling myself, okay, he's a nice guy. And yeah, like, you know, I kind of like him, but come on, this is going to be hard. And, you know. Yeah,
and our dating began as double dating for the first two, three, four times out, because it was safer. Nashville is not the safest space for anyone other than people who have shotguns in their gun rack. They're pretty safe themselves. But you get beyond the college domain, it gets fairly interesting.
Well, certainly in the late 1960s.
Yeah, we're speaking 65 to 67. Right. Those were the 2 years.
We went to see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and came out of it, and there were a small group of little old white ladies who, if I'd known the word then, I would have said were trolling us. But they wanted us to know that that situation that was happening, it was never happening in their house. That was just not, you know. And were there moments that were scary? Yeah, there were some moments that were scary. Driving, I can't remember where we were driving from.
St. Louis.
That might have been it.
Through Indiana?
Through Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I was not as aware as Ed was that there was a truck or a car following us. And they had...
They had a truck with a cab, with a gun rack, with rifles in it. And they had their window down, and they would do up and back on the expressway. And they would do up and back, up and back, so the driver of the car would know they're paying real close attention to everybody that's in that car, and they knew one of them didn't belong.
And I think I wasn't as aware of it. Ed sort of drew my attention to the fact that that car was behaving very strangely. We completed that trip, and what I didn't know for years later was that Ed went out and bought a gun. And he carried that gun in the glove compartment of the car whenever we were traveling. That said to me that he was very, we weren't just talking about people saying mean things or making a scene, but that there was a very real and visceral danger that he had perceived. And while, you know, absolutely, I said, well, we're not doing guns. We're just not going to live like that. There was a part of me that was really glad that for those years when we were traveling on the road, that that was available to us. Because clearly, I mean, the world was not looking at us and saying, oh, what a great couple. So yeah, there were definitely scary moments. Mm-hmm. My experience and perception of white people before we met and entered into a relationship, part of my perception was that these are not people that you trusted. Not because anything in particular had happened to me, but from unspoken things that my parents said. Mm-hmm. I understood that from the conversations that happened around the Greensboro sit-ins and the bus boycotts and all of those kinds of things. I understood that from the fact that I thought my mother was going to have a brain aneurysm, the one and only time that my older sister babysat for a young white couple. And instead of my sister calling her when the couple came home, the husband drove my sister home. I mean, there was great deal of teeth gnashing and so forth. And I didn't quite understand why until my sister got home and my mother explained to her, you are never going to babysit again unless it's family or church members. And she then sat us down and she said, here is the deal. You're a young black girl. If he decided to abuse, ruin you, that's what people said in those days. If he decided to ruin you, there would almost be nothing that your father and I could do about it. The courts wouldn't believe you. He would always have the upper hand, but you would be ruined. And that's not going to happen. So I understood that racial separations that I had grown up with all of my life was not to be entered into lightly. Even though there were blacks and whites walking on the lines in Selma and so forth and so on, when it came down to one-on-one relationships, these were dangerous, they were ill-informed, they were not to be entered into. So I don't think I was afraid when I turned Ed down for a ride. I really did think, you know, he's just another guy. Oh, by the way, he's white. What could he have been thinking? But certainly the racial thing came into play.
My parents owned a little neighborhood grocery store. My job as a little boy working for the parents included carrying groceries for black people who were going and white people who were going, but basically poor people. And I carried groceries for people and I had conversation. And then there was an open field where we played pickup baseball. And the young African-American boys and the young white boys would get out there. There would be some words here and there, but you can't argue with talent. And, you know, you start choosing teams. And so this guy is really good. And when he's pitching, I want to bat because I know how to get him. So I hadn't spent any more time in terms of summers and after school and on weekends with one race any more than another. And I learned lots of very interesting things just by listening to people as we were walking. Because when you're walking with this little old lady, you let her talk.
When I entered college, I always knew that I was going to have a career. And, I'll marry some nice guy, which always in my head would have been a nice black guy, and life will go on. And there was a lot of conversation on campus, as you can imagine, because I was in college from 64 to 68. The Voter Rights Act was taking place. You know, I took part in canvassing black neighborhoods to try to encourage people to register to vote, because most black people simply did not vote because they couldn't. So I was very involved with those kinds of issues. The conversations around race had much more to do with encouraging black folks to know their rights, to take advantage of their rights. That's the racial conversation we were having on campus. We were not talking about what if you have a boyfriend or what if you meet a girl, because I don't think anyone assumed that that was going to be a part of our lives. To give you kind of an example of how the other students on my campus, at least, treated us once it was clear that we were a couple. My best girlfriend was being pinned, which means that her boyfriend was in a fraternity and he was going to give his fraternity pin to her as a kind of promise before being engaged. It's a big deal for girls on campus. And it's a ceremony that's a little private and so forth. So that happened, but there was a party afterwards, right? And we go to the party, and my friend is so excited, and she has a little bit too much to drink. And so she's walking around saying, oh, I just got pinned. Did you know I got pinned? At one point, I don't know whether Ed had said something to her, like, congratulations, oh yeah, I heard, you know. And she leaned over on him and she said, oh, nigga, you have no idea, or something to them. She called him a nigger. And she, oh, I'm so sorry. Well, he thought it was the greatest thing in the world. It was like he had also been initiated that night, okay?
And yes, I took that as an unguarded, spontaneous moment of acknowledgement that she and I were as close as we could possibly be.
Yeah.
In terms of friendship.
I think I put him through, or asked him to jump through a number of hoops, certainly before we were engaged or married. I think I tested him in ways that were not fair.
As I'm finishing up my senior year and you're finishing up your junior year, I remember you saying, we may or may not continue our relationship beyond this year, but whatever happens, I have no regrets about the time.
I remember that very well.
We've been there.
Yeah. And I think that was one of those tests I put him through, which was just, he was going off to grad school.
Yeah.
And I thought, you know, we're going to be in different cities. We shouldn't be dating. This long distance thing, I don't know what that's all about. Yeah. And so I basically said to him, you're going to be meeting new people. You're going to have da-da-da-da-da. You know, let's just consider ourselves good friends. And I think I even got him to say, you know, we should, if we found someone that we wanted to date, we should date. And that just turned out miserably for both of us. The first time that Ed came to visit me at my parents' home, and of course I told them I was dating this guy, I had a picture of him in a frame that I brought home with me. And by the way, he's white. I wasn't quite sure what the reaction was going to be. A little bit to my surprise, there was not a big deal about it. They wanted to know where he was from, what he planned to do in life. And my dad said, well, you know, I need to know if he's a good guy, but I'll know that when I meet him. My mother and I had a little conversation off to the side, and she said, you know, I have to tell you, marriage is not what you think it's going to be when you first enter into it. And you better be really, really sure with this guy. She said, I don't care what color he is. You better be really, really sure, because there are going to be some really difficult times. But, you know, I was all, sure. They were very, very good. I overheard my mother having a phone conversation. I'm not quite sure who it was with. When I walked into the room, she was saying, you know, Bob and I talked about it, Bob being my father. And what we decided was, the minute she told us he was white, what we decided was she clearly was serious about this guy. And our choice was to run the risk of losing a daughter or accepting him. And we decided that we were going to try to accept him. She never said that directly to me, but I heard that. Not quite so easy with Ed's family. There was a spring break when Ed went home to visit his parents to tell them that we were, I don't know whether we were engaged then or you were.
I think we were engaging.
We were engaged, yes.
We were becoming engaged.
I think he was about to give me a ring. But he was going to basically say to his parents, you know, this is a serious relationship and I'm about to ask her to marry me. And I knew that was happening and I was really nervous for him. I got a call at my dorm from Ed saying, you know, my mother would like to talk with you. So I got on the phone with his mother. She was calm enough at the beginning, but she worked herself into quite a frenzy. Very fundamentalist type of mindset. The kind of thing, birds and fish don't mate.
And if you loved him, you would let him go.
Yeah, she did say that.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I don't forget those conversations either, as hard and difficult as they were.
And I really didn't quite know what to say to her. I just recall saying that I was not the problem, that all she needed to do was to convince him that this was not a good relationship, I had no hold on him. And if he did not want to be in this relationship again, it was over with. So I think I said something about, you know, having raised the kind of son that didn't have the same kind of beliefs about people of different cultures and different colors, but that her issue was not with me. I remember she kept going on, and she was clearly working herself, very upset about it. And I didn't know how to end the conversation. Yet. And at some point, Ed came on the line, and he said to her, "Okay, Mother, I said that I would let you talk to Florence, and I think you've said all that you need to say, and that's enough." And he said to me, "I'll be back tomorrow." And that was it. So they didn't come to our wedding. No one from his family came to our wedding. All of the guys, there were 5 bridesmaids, I think, and all of the groomsmen were members of my family or friends or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until 6 years later that we visited them for the first time.
Mm-hmm. My father never betrayed a thought one side or the other.
Except that this is what I remember. The first, when our children were 6 and a year old, and we went to Arkansas to visit Ed's parents, I never heard a word from his father about how he felt about our relationship until that visit. And he and I happened to be in the living room at the same time. And he said to me, "My wife and I chose an easier path than you and Ed did. But I can see now that even though you selected a more difficult road for yourself, that you seem to know how to handle it." And I think that's what I was most worried about, whether you could handle it. I was totally speechless, completely speechless, you know? My sense of his mother coming around was sort of an inevitable thing. And it kind of felt as though I knew that she was less aggravated, agitated on that visit because at her insistence, we all were going out to dinner. So I thought, well, that says something to me because, you know, we're all going to sit at the same table and so forth. We did not all go to her church, however, because I think that would have been something different for her to have to explain the physical presence of her son walking in not only with a black wife, but 2 little black kids. I mean, you know. And she visited us several times after that. So I think she definitely came around. But it was a much more difficult thing for her to swallow. I do recall his mother used to call with some frequency, you know, just to talk. But when I answered the phone, which was often the case, there was no, "Oh, hi, Florence. How are you? How are the boys? You know, is Ed there?" It was always, "This is Gertrude. Is Ed there?" And I took offense at that. And so I remember saying to Ed at one point, "This is how your mother addresses me on the phone. Enough. So you need to explain to her. I mean, when she calls, the only woman that ought to be picking up the phone is your wife. So you need to say that to her." And I think he did have that conversation because that changed. And I tell that story only to say that while we didn't have a lot of interaction, I think there was a real and true acceptance. I think she didn't always know how to move from that initial conversation we'd have over the phone to say, "Gee, I'm sorry that happened," or, you know, whatever. Not that I was looking for it. But I definitely saw signs that it changed. I felt terrible for him, quite frankly, because I felt terrible that his family chose not to come to the wedding. Here I was surrounded by family and friends and not Ed. Mm-hmm. I felt terrible that I knew that when she called to talk to her boys, she wasn't comfortable having a conversation with me, and I knew that he knew that, and I thought, God, what a position to be in.
I knew I wanted to be with Florence and that I would be with Florence. I knew I loved my mother and I wasn't going to throw her away. And I didn't quite know how to keep those two in equipoise. But that's what it was.
We were married for 3 years before we decided to start a family. And we had conversations about the fairness of bringing biracial children into the world. You have to also understand, I mean, the Vietnam War was going on. Dr. King had been assassinated, the Kennedy assassination. I mean, there was just so much going on. The world did not seem like a friendly place. We had no friends who were in long-term relationships who were biracial. We had no friends to say, oh, well, I see you have two children and they're X number of years old. How has that been? And we had lots of conversations around, well, you know, what does it mean? And what will they look like? And what will people say? Obviously, we decided to have children. But by that time, it was the early 70s. Our sense was, yes, all of this really bad stuff was happening in the world. But we thought that there were also some good signs as well. And we sort of thought that, well, by the time these children reach an age of consciousness, whatever that is, maybe things will have changed enough. And in the meantime, we're going to protect them.
We named our first son Gregory. Second name is Ibata, and that's Bantu. And that Gregory means vigilant, awareness, awake. And that Ibata means courageous, emboldened. For the both of us gives a very, very sharp, bright light on who we were at that point in our lives. We needed a child who was going to be very, very alert and very courageous because it is a rough world out there. Similarly with Philip, 5 years later, Philip is Greek, lover of horses, more generally lover of nature. And his middle name is Yoruba, and it's Atiba. And it means lover of wisdom or seeker of knowledge. Nature and knowledge, it's quieter, it's reflective, it's depth. That's where Florence and I saw ourselves more closely, independently of the naming.
How do you raise biracial children and try to have them come out intact? And there isn't a parent in the world that has a complete answer for that. But I did think a lot about it, and I thought that a lot of the responsibility would come to me and for me to bring that conversation to Ed so that we could partner in it in ways that we could, simply because I felt that I had much more experience in this area. But how in the world do you decide what your 8-year-old needs to know when he's going to overnight camp for the first time? And he's absolutely going to be in a bunk with kids who are not biracial or African-American or, you know, what do you say to him? I didn't want to say to my little boys, now listen, when you go out the door every day, there are going to be mean people who might say mean things to you. That's not the conversation you ever want to have. So for me, I was always on the cusp of how much do you warn them? And how much do you steel yourself to be ready to have a conversation when it's brought to you? I would say that each of our children would say that in growing up, there were some hurtful moments. Yet they had people, classmates say, well, what are you? Because they saw mom and dad come to parents' meeting or whatever. They had kids say, that's your mom and dad? Yeah, I told you I was mixed. Oh, I didn't know you meant that kind of mix, you know. So I think for me, there was a combination of watching and waiting. And I didn't catch all of it. But I will honestly tell you that I used to have practice conversations with myself about what if someone calls you this. And only one of those make-believe conversations was I able to actually put into practice, because it happened almost on time, when another kid said to my kid, "You zebra something, something, something." And he didn't know what zebra meant, but he knew it wasn't good. Okay. And he couldn't wait to get home, ask me. And I practiced that conversation. All the other practice conversations just went out the window. Mm-hmm. Went out the window.
When Gregory was in the sixth grade, things had been happening here and there at school that were systemic and were racist and were racializing, but sufficiently severe that we removed him from public school. And we sought an independent school for him, and because Philip's 5 years younger, it worked just right, so Philip never went to public school. But we made that choice not to do public school, even though we were in the most privileged, you know, either Lower Merion. It's very, very sad, yeah. But that's another dimension of what we encountered as an interracial couple.
We were all about public school. And for us, it simply didn't work, primarily because we ran into a teacher who just didn't understand this little boy who loved math so much that he was sneaking and doing math during recess and, you know, corrupting three of his other classmates doing it. And she humiliated him in front of the class and took his workbook away from him. And he was 8. He knew he'd done something awful, but he didn't know what it was.
He didn't know what it was.
You know, that was when we had to name what was taking place. Mm-hmm. When his math teacher takes the workbook away and stands him in front of the class to say what a bad person he is because he did what she told them not to do, which was to work ahead, we were forced to say, eventually, you have a teacher who's a bigot, and that is what is fueling her behavior.
When they were growing up and they and would be with me out and about, nobody would think anything about, or no one would show anything about what they might be thinking. And I think similarly, when they were with you, no one would be thinking out loud about anything going
on. Actually, not quite so. With our older son, there was a little variety store in our neighborhood within walking distance of our house when he was a toddler. And we often, he and I would walk to the park, and then we'd come around the other way and we'd stop by the little variety store and we'd pick up a little something, you know, for dinner. And we did that often enough so that the guy who owned it or managed it recognized us. And one day we stopped in and, you know, I picked up something that I had ordered ahead of time. And the manager said, "So you taking that to your house or to his house?" Meaning to my house or my son's house. And it takes you a second. I said, "Well, yeah, we're going home." And he said, "Yeah, but you're taking it to..." He thought that I must be the nanny or the maid, because that was clearly a little white boy that I was with every day and walking and so forth. And I do remember when Gregory was young, he was kind of was sallow complexion. His color hadn't come in yet. It was more paleness than anything else. But that happened a couple of times, that on our regular routine, someone would become brave enough to try to figure out what our relationship was, basically. You go along and they get invited to all the birthday parties, you know, when all the kids are little and so forth, and all the bar mitzvahs and all the bat mitzvahs. And then you get to high school and people are starting to show up in couples. Now, both of them dated when they were in high school, but I know that there were parents who had known these kids since they were little bitty, who were not happy that they were dating as teenagers. And so then you have to have that conversation. And I think none of their white friends, male or female, ever had parents have the talk. And you don't have it when they're 16 and getting their license for the first time. You cycle through it. But it's a sadness to have to sit down and say, okay, you're old enough to go out to the little local strip mall to buy a gift for your friend's party. So here's the deal. Because Dad and I aren't going to be with you. This is how you have to act. Don't touch anything you're not going to buy, and so forth and so on. And our bottom line was, if anything happens, you just do what you're asked to do, because your only job is to come home. Dad and I'll handle it from there. And trying to make them think that somehow we were magical and invincible. We know what to do. You know, we know how to handle these things. But the point was, you come home. That's your one and only job. It's a real sadness to have to say that to your children.
By and large, I don't think in the kinds of terms that would racialize my engagement with my sons or my wife. So I accept absolutely what you say. That's all true.
I know.
I've had very few conversations about race. I've had far more instructions on race from both Greg and Phil. Phil in particular, I would copy him, blind copy him, you know, emails and so on. And then once he got into the biz, at some point he said, not too long into it, he says, okay, Dad, yeah, you can do that stuff when you're talking to senior administrative officers, and I've been there forever and ever. Yeah, you can do that stuff, Dad. You're white. I ain't. I can't. I've got to find other ways of doing it. So in that sense, I'm learning from the recognitions that our sons are coming to have, coming out of their day-to-day lives.
This current administration makes me feel as though we have jetted back in time. It feels as though so many things that I would have said to you, we're kind of done with that. We're not. And that's my mistake. A lot of us made that mistake. And it makes me more than nervous. It's scary. It's really scary. But at the same time, I do believe that there are more people who have come to a point in their thinking that we're never going to be where we were in the mid to late 60s. I absolutely believe that. I've even said that to particularly young people who have said to me, so frustrating, so frustrating. We thought we marched. We thought we did this. We thought that that was done. And here we are the next year or 2 years. And I have said things to them like, maybe it's not so important that you actually be around to see the change. Maybe the most important thing is that the fight you join is a righteous one, and that someone's carrying it forward. So I have to say that to myself now. It's not that the gains that we thought were made have completely disappeared. We're just in a regressive phase. And that's the way humans move. We take X number of steps forward, mm-hmm. and then we fall back. I wish we didn't have to do these things again. I'm going to be 71 in a few weeks. I don't want to be in the middle of a demonstration. Nothing makes me happier than to be home with a good book, a glass of wine, and my feet up. That's my nirvana, all right? But I will. I absolutely will. I can't say to my granddaughter or my children or anyone else that it's their turn. So we're back in it, mm-hmm. you know, and that's, mm-hmm. maybe it's not quite, I can't even say it's not quite the same, because yeah, there are people doing absolutely outrageous and unimaginable kinds of things. But there are also a great many people who are saying, this won't stand. We're not going to allow this to happen. And the truth is, I would be much less concerned if I were a young couple who had decided to have children, bringing them into the world today, as crazy as it is, than I was in 68. It's not the same anomaly to see a black and white couple today as it was when we were dating and first married. There are more biracial children in the world. And so when my granddaughter goes to school, she won't be the only biracial child in her classroom. And that makes a difference.
We'd like to thank Florence and Ed for sharing their story with us. The Loving Project is available on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and just about anywhere else you find podcasts. And if you like the show, please consider leaving a review.
You can find out more about the podcast at our website, lovingproject.com, where you'll also find pictures of some of the couples profiled on the show and ways to follow us on social media. And if you'll be in the Philadelphia area in June, check out the website for details about our gallery show, featuring photographs and audio from the Loving Project. The exhibit opens June 9th, and it'll be open to the public the following three Saturdays. I'm Brad Linder.
And I'm Farrah Parks. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project.
In the next episode of The Loving Project, we'll hear from Mike and Kim.
Mike is Asian, and Kim is white. They've been together for about a decade. Shortly after they started dating, they went to a Halloween party together.
We walk in, and this woman was dressed in like a stereotypical Chinese costume.
Coolie hat, a robe, buck teeth, the Coke bottle glasses. And then she comes up to me, and she, you know, says, "Oh, can I take your picture?" Like in the voice. And I was just like, "Get away from me." And I just walked past her. I was like, for like 10 seconds, I was just really confused. I was like, we still live in this world.
And I felt bad that was like my family. Like my brother would be friends with someone.
Was your brother's boss?
It was my brother's boss and his wife.
Kim and Mike's story, coming up next time on The Loving Project.